I could have played for the national team.
We'll take you.
You don't really don't want him.
Rude.
Welcome back to the streets. Will remember. My name is Hani Jabber.
I'm Justin Salhani. Hey, Hani, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Have you seen the trailer for this Amazon Prime documentary of Tottenham Hot Mess?
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be so good. It's going to be a train wreck. Absolute train wreck.
Supposedly, they caught everything on this one, including the fact that like Lloris and Son got into a big fight on Monday. Should be pretty spicy.
Someone I know posted, I don't know if it's actually true, but a screenshot of Christian Eriksen like seeing the news that Jose Mourinho has been appointed. And it is just, this is the kind of stuff I just want to see. I just want to see the reactions to good old Jose coming in. The woman we're talking about today, I'll introduce her. Her name is Mary Abigail Wambach, most commonly known as Abby Wambach. Justin, what do you remember most about Abby?
So I actually have a pretty cool anecdote because I've played with Abby Wambach before. Abby must have been in her early 20s, around there. I was 17. And my club soccer coach was the assistant coach of what at the time was called the Washington Freedom. He used to bring occasionally like a player out to train. And so he brought Abby out. And this game was seriously some of the most fun football I've ever played because it was just filled with incredibly technical, intelligent, skillful, daring players. And Abby, she was never a technician, right? But she was a competitor. She had good technique. You know, her hold-up play was great. And I just remember her being really intense. So for example, when our coach was called Clyde Watson, he would pause the game to give tactical instructions. She would start doing sprints up and down the pitch. You could see that. That was an elite level of drive and commitment. She was really hard on herself too. So if she took a bad touch, like if she laid the ball off and it didn't go to the target she intended, she'd just like scream in the air. And it was really cool to have that experience, to play with somebody who she's on the level of all-time greats.
That level of intensity that we see in professional players in every sport, that level of intensity is so needed when it's so competitive. Like every element, you know, what you're eating, how you're running is like being watched and monitored and so on. And that must be so hard to maintain, both physically and mentally.
Zinedine Zidane has said many times that when he was, you know, a teenager, there were a lot of really good players. But a lot of them fall off, you know, they fall into partying, they fall into drugs or drink or whatever else. That same team that I was just talking about training with, when I had joined them, they had just gotten back from Holland and they had done a tour and played the youth teams of the top clubs, PSV, Ajax, etc. And they said there was a guy on Ajax who was unreal talented, that dribbled everyone on the pitch. Like he dribbled 8 players before he scored a goal. That guy was Ryan Babel. And if you remember when Ryan Babel was 18, 19 coming through, like he was unreal. Ryan Babel didn't have that elite next level career. I mean, he had a solid career. He played for some good clubs. When he was 18, 19, he might have been on a par with all the other top talents globally that were the same age. Then there are some guys who maintained it because they kept training at a certain level. They kept playing at a certain level. They had a bit of luck. They had some coaches, the right coaches who gave them the right feedback. You can flame out really quick because you have that human side. And so it takes crazy devotion to keep that throughout a career.
Look, what I remember from her, watching her and then going back and watching some of these clips, she's exactly the kind of forward I wish I could play with now.
Yeah, she's a cold goal scorer.
Cold scorer. And look, I play with incredible, typical forward, very quick, plays off the shoulder of the attack, loves a through ball.
The Inzaghi type.
Yeah, very good. But Abby is the other type of forward I wish I could play with, you know, that's always in and around the box, looking in and could create a goal just out of nothing. And nothing's a greater example of that than the 2011 World Cup game against Brazil.
That header?
That header, yeah, that header. Rapinoe plays it from a stupid position to play across, like generally speaking. Mm-hmm. But you know you're playing it to Abby. You know you're playing it to Abby Wambach, and you know that anything can happen if it lands on her head. And it does. And that is the exact type of forward you want to be playing with because it just gives you that confidence to know that the person in front always has your back, always.
I think that's a great point. I think when you play with a forward who is maybe, you know, is maybe smaller, needs the ball in certain spaces, you kind of check yourself. You say, okay, am I playing a good enough pass? Is the run good enough? But when you've got a striker who's elite, who you know can create out of nothing, and all you really got to do is get it towards their vicinity, that changes the game, because all you need is that little bit of space to slide the ball in, or just to, like you said with Rapinoe, just lob it in her direction, because at the end, like, she'll be able to do something magical with it.
That's right. And there's an element of, like, it also drives your creativity a little bit more, because you can try other things. Because if you're playing with a certain type of forward where you know you've got to be pinpoint with what you do, you know that it actually takes away some of your creativity, because you're focused so much on your technique, on the pass. Whereas if you're playing with someone that can turn things around on their own as well, you can try something a bit more audacious. And I think the reason Abby Wambach got 184 goals in 250 games for the U.S. national team is because the players around her just trusted her and knew that the ball was going to find its way to the net.
We talked a little bit pre-show, and you mentioned that she scored more goals than she had club games throughout her career.
Yeah, so she only played 119 club games.
You know, I think that speaks a lot to the kind of the power dynamic in the women's game, and how for a long time, you know, we talked about Marta before, how a lot of her clubs folded. The top stars, which are the Rapinos, the, you know, the Abby Wambachs, the Rose Lavelles, the Alex Morgans.
Greatest celebration of all time.
The teacup celebration.
Oh, yeah, that was... Every English person I knew, like, was so angry.
Yeah, they showed them true selves when that happened, didn't it?
It was beautiful. It was beautiful. I mean, yeah. She's an incredible football player, don't get me wrong, but that is the greatest celebration in history.
Most of their money comes from the national team. That completely changes the dynamic of the importance, and it also changes the dynamic of the growth of the game, because you're effectively keeping a very small circle of development, and you can't develop the players the same way that you can through a league.
It almost changes the balance, right? Because we look at club level in the men's game, and then the international games are always so disjointed.
That's absolutely true. I think this is a good time for us to go take a quick break, and we're going to come back with our first guest on The Streets Will Remember.
Yeah, can't wait. Looking forward to it.
Welcome back. We're going to talk legacy now. And with us, we have our first guest on the podcast, Jess Malone. Jess, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a tremendous honor to be your first guest.
We're the lucky ones here that you're up pretty early to speak to us. Starting off, can you tell us a bit about Abby Wambach and what you feel her legacy is?
First of all, she's a Gemini, which I think explains quite a bit. She speaks in her memoir about kind of the dueling personalities of chill Abby versus intense Abby. And I think over the course of her career, you see that come out. She's the thread between the 99ers and the current iteration of the national team. You know, you see that in the trophies that she won and the trophies that she didn't win as well, and the personal responsibility that she felt to win games and celebrate those women in the ways that she felt they deserve. She also was battling with alcohol and prescription drug issues through most of her career. She's been very open about that afterwards, but it's important to note that she wasn't even functioning in peak physical condition for most of her career. She had the all-time goals record for international career goals scored by man or woman from until January 2020, when Christine Sinclair of Canada broke it. So I know for me, it took a second to sink in of, oh, that's all goals of anyone, man or woman, international career.
I didn't actually know that until I was doing research for this episode. That kind of information wasn't more publicized, because I'm trying to read a lot about football and I feel like I would have come across that, but I feel like it just wasn't discussed.
Yeah, and just to be clear, that's 184 goals. Given the failing of the club football structure in the United States, where the national team was the only games that Abby was playing, and U.S. soccer recognized that, and so they generally were playing more games for the women's team than they would for the men's teams. And then before we get onto her, kind of the timeline of her legacy, I only saw her play in person once. I was living in Colorado. She came on as a sub for Kristen Press, didn't score any goals. And what's most notable about this day is that a few hours after that game, U.S. Soccer fired Tom Sormani, who was coach at the time. This was, you know, 14 months out from the 2015 World Cup. And there are kind of rumors of a bit of a player, not a revolt, but the players felt something needed to change leading into the World Cup. And Jill Ellis was appointed interim manager. So her career with the national team started in 2001. So she played for over 14 years. Her first big tournament was the World Cup in 2003, but the U.S. lost to Germany in the semifinal, and Abby's mark gave up the first goal on a corner kick. And she really, in her memoir, speaks about feeling like that loss was her fault, and she let the 99ers down. The WUSA had just folded on the eve of that tournament. So the Mia Hamms, the Julie Foudies of the world, to be able to win back-to-back World Cups in 2003, they felt really would have invigorated the interest in the club game in the U.S. So Abby took that loss really hard, but in the 2004 Olympics, which most of the 99ers had announced it was going to be their last tournament, she scored in the 112th minute against Brazil, which was the winner in the gold medal game. So, you know, there's some stories about them personally thanking her for not ruining the next 40 years of their lives by letting them go out with that gold medal.
Stakes seem to me, at least, to be much higher on the women's game, not just because this will change the next 40 years of the outcome, but it's not just for the country, it's like for the world even.
Yeah, I mean, if a league had been successful at that point, or if they could have come back with some iteration of it right away, who knows what that would have done. The WPS didn't start until 2009. So we went basically 6 years with no top level club women's soccer in the United States. And if you think about someone like Abby Wambach, who had just, you know, launched her national team career and is trying to make it as a club footballer, you know, and there's the structure in Europe maybe wasn't there yet or wasn't, you know, an option that was desired by the players. That's complete insanity. And it's no fault of their own. And you think about where things could be both in terms of player development, not just for the U.S. players, but other female players who would have come and played in that league at this time and how far that could have pushed things along. It's kind of like when you think about what if they hadn't banned women's football in England, where would things be now? So for Abby, she was clubless basically from 2003 to 2009. She played in, I think, 3 games for Ajax America Women in 2005 during that time, but that was at 3 club games in that whole time.
Jeez.
And then after the WPS folded from 2011 to 2013 until the NWSL started, she was clubless.
Something that we were talking about earlier, the amount of pressure that's put on like the women's game, especially in the US. I was actually speaking to an Australian journalist, football journalist, last week. Australia just won, along with New Zealand, the World Cup rights for 2023. And one of the things he said was, the women's game has the opportunity, especially in Australia, to grow football more than the men's game has ever done. Because the love for the women's team is a lot more wholesome. It's a lot less politicized, and it's a lot less driven by politics and scars of football. That's a lot of pressure on the women's game.
I see it from, I guess you could say, both sides. That's absolutely true. I think that women and fans of the women's game have every right to also be scumbags. And I think that that shouldn't be held against them if they do. You know, we saw this a lot with the Women's World Cup last year about they have to be positive role models. And it's their responsibility to grow the game. And I think that's bullshit. But you can't deny the facts. That can absolutely grow the game. And these women are incredible and do deserve all of that attention. I agree. But I think people need to allow room for all of the negativity too.
Being a role model doesn't mean being a perfect human. I think it's just kind of trying to be an example. And so I think some of the heat poured on somebody like Pino for celebrating a goal, or for Alex Morgan for celebrating a goal, you nailed it. Like, hypocritical is the best way that I can think of. You know, we talk about like how somebody views a character like Zlatan versus how they view somebody like Rapinoe, who it's not even close in terms of the arrogance.
Yeah, so there's room for the global conversation to develop around that for sure. And I hope by the time Australia, New Zealand rolls around, they let Sam Kerr be, you know, as that's ostentatious that she wants.
It's insane how much they love her here. It's amazing. So I guess one of the things you mentioned, or her struggle with alcohol and
Yeah, it was caffeine pills, Ambien, an alcohol mixture, I think, with some Vicodin for, you know, various injuries.
She's definitely been vocal about certain things as well, post-career. Do you think that's shaped her legacy moving forward?
I do. I think that started kind of toward the end of her career, both getting control of, you know, her use of those substances. And, you know, if you look at her spearheading the lawsuit for gender discrimination against FIFA and the Canadian Soccer Association for making them play a World Cup on turf. You know, I think something like that really made her say, hey, I have a voice. I need to use it. This is bullshit. I'm going to speak up about this. She also, in her memoir, spoke to thinking about the end of her career and realizing that she was still going to have to actively seek out work and a salary because she's a woman. She really felt that, you know, whereas if she had been a male player, that might be, oh, hey, come just be a commentator. Oh, hey, be a columnist. We got you. To not have to think about that in some way. I think there was one year when she won an award at the ESPYs, and I think she was on stage with Peyton Manning and Kobe Bryant and just looking at them like, these men are set for life and I have to keep hustling. So, you know, by the time they win the 2015 World Cup and, you know, everyone knows that she's out and has a wife, but for them to celebrate that victory by sharing a kiss when they know that the TV cameras are on them and they're not going to have time to cut away or do whatever they want, I think by the end of her career, she started, you know, to get her voice out there because she knew people were listening.
You know, somebody who grew up in the U.S. like you did, it feels like soccer was often marketed to white suburban people, really on both sides of the game. But I know, like, even maybe even more so on the women's side of the game. And I guess, like, what I'm thinking here is kind of the contrast, in a sense, like, when we talk about white suburban kind of going outside of the cities, you know, you think more maybe centrist, right-wing, Republican. And right, these were the people that were often being marketed to. And then you have these players that have completely different, maybe politics, views, beliefs, or just, like, their being does not fit that sort of image. And you even saw, like, you know, Michael Jordan's legacy up until very recently, he didn't speak out about police brutality, racial discrimination, mm-hmm, any, you know, anything like that. And there's a famous quote that's attributed to him, Republicans buy sneakers too. So I'm not really going towards a point here or anything. I just kind of wanted to bring up kind of that interesting ambivalence or duality. To me, she was the first, in women's football, at least in the United States, first openly, almost sort of activist. And I'm wondering if Abby was able to set the way for athletes that have followed and taken these stands and pushed for equality between the men's and the women's game with the national team.
She definitely was, whether that was just in a locker room setting. She grew up in a super Catholic family. I think she was one of six or seven siblings. And so coming out to her own family was extremely challenging. You know, her first wife was an NWSL player. And just kind of a funny story, at the 2012 FIFA ceremony, after Abby had won World Player of the Year, Sepp Blatter thought that Abby's wife was Marta, even though Marta had won that award every year from 2006 to 2010. You're both face-palming right now, which is the completely appropriate reaction. Not only are you out and you're taking your wife to the FIFA World Player of the Year ceremony, but the president of FIFA is mistaking her for someone who's won this award five times. When you think about the microaggressions or the layers of discrimination that someone like Abby was dealing with, that was in 2012. And how did you not get angry about that or upset and feel the need to propel everything forward? You know, that kind of culminates now in, after the U.S. won the 2019 World Cup, Kelly O'Hara, who was not publicly out, went and kissed her partner in the stands, her female partner in the stands. And everyone was like, oh my God, Kelly O'Hara is not even out. This is huge. And now, in fast forward to 2020, and Alex Morgan is making Instagram posts about defunding the police. So, you know, I absolutely think that Abby and her, not even, I don't even know if it was intentional activism, but her refusal to be apologetic for who she was or her refusal to try to hide those things was a really big part of where the U.S. national team is now.
You know, we've talked a little bit about her use of substances, and that kind of shows her as a human. However, I do want to touch on something that I would like to be a bit more critical of, which is her comment on dual nationals, because we're getting into questions of nationalism, questions of pledging yourself to a country. And, you know, obviously these comments came in sort of what seems like a very different time, though. It was like 4 years ago.
Well, it was December 2015. So the Trump rhetoric was kind of reaching fever pitch leading into the primaries. And so, you know, she said it on a Bill Simmons podcast. And I remember the headline, seeing the headline and feeling like I had been punched in the stomach. For that to make a headline so soon after her retirement, so soon after the Women's World Cup 2015 victory, just seemed like, oh, this is not what the world needs right now. And at the 2014 World Cup, the U.S. men's team had only scored 5 goals, and 3 of those goals were scored by German Americans, and the other 2 were scored by Clint Dempsey. It just seemed like, oh no, why does this have to be happening? And you don't often have men's and women's players of national teams from the same country sort of taking shots at each other or even acknowledging that each other exists at all. So it was shocking. And she kind of doubled down on it a little bit in a New York Times interview in 2016 and has since sort of provided some clarity. It's debatable whether the authenticity of that, but she has come out and said she was actually criticizing Jurgen Klinsmann. And if you dig into the details of what she actually said, that is sort of the lead in, but it's absolutely problematic. There's no question about that. Although it is worth mentioning that in January of 2017, Tim Howard said similar comments in a USA Today interview and got a lot less headlines.
I really find all forms of nationalism kind of problematic. I think a lot of that has always been because I've been given purity tests. My father grew up in Lebanon. Whenever I was growing up in the US, people were like, oh, but you're not really American. You have another passport. Your name is this and da 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 da. You know, at the end of the day, I think identity is a complex thing. And, you know, some people have one nationality, but for those of us who have had kind of a mix, you know, there is no purity. And so those comments were extremely problematic. And when Tim Howard came out and said it, I found it extremely problematic. And I found it even more problematic when Tev Ramos came out a couple years later talking about the Jonathan Gonzalez case and said, if you feel Mexican, play for Mexico, with kind of that shrug of the shoulders sort of. You're seeing, like, for example, in France, a lot of players are choosing to play for their parents' nation. They're playing for the Ivory Coast, they're playing for Algeria, rather than playing for France. And I think a lot of that is because they don't feel accepted. And what is an American? You know, I mean, we've had a lot of these talks, especially now under the Trump administration. What does it mean to be an American? You can criticize Jurgen Klinsmann, his decisions to call up certain players, absolutely, but not based on their, you know, not based on their identity.
Her words in particular, if you dig into what she actually said, it kind of got worse. I'm paraphrasing here, but she said something about the, you know, how can these players play their heart out for the United States?
There's a number, very large percentage of people in the United States of American citizens, born American citizens, who have never felt part of the American project. And so how are they supposed to play their heart out for the country at the same time? So, you know, this is based in something deeper. And I don't, you know, I don't want to speak for her or say she doesn't know what she's talking about. Because I think a lot of times when people say these things, there's a meaning, which, like you said, she was probably trying to criticize Klinsmann's decision making, but the effects of those words go a lot further.
Yeah, it's the impact versus intent. I don't think her intent was necessarily to make headlines with that. I'm sure she just thought, oh, I'm on this Bill Simmons podcast and he asked me what I think of Jurgen Klinsmann. But, you know, in her role, and especially in that political climate, and even if it's not that political climate, to say those words out loud is certainly, it's a choice.
No one is perfect, and I'm not trying to excuse anything that she said or any of the elements that she's done, but no, we are probably talking about
this is going to be good. This is going to be good.
No, I'm just transitioning. The success that she had in her playing career between winning the World Cup, 2 Olympic golds, scoring the number of goals that she did, basically motivating and bringing in the amount of new girls and women into the sport in the US, growing the game globally, you know, these are just parts of the legacy that she sort of will leave behind in the game.
Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll do the Pantheon.
Welcome back, everyone.
We're doing Pantheon. Hany, what's the Pantheon this week?
I think we're going to go with greatest American soccer player.
Abby Wambach. Done.
Done.
Good episode, guys.
I think this was part of the struggle for us with this one. he's going to end up as number one. And I think what's probably more important here is to discuss why she ends up as number one.
Just why don't you lead us off? Why is she the greatest American soccer player?
Well, she has 184 goals. Mia is next after that with 158.
Mia Hamm went to my high school. So that's a high school greatness right there. Yeah.
Oh, wow, Mia Hamm and Justin Salhani. That's incredible. Right.
One of us is really famous and one of us is Mia Hamm. So.
I did a little bit of math here and her goals per cap comes out to 0.72. So that's elite. So she's number one on the all-time USA goals list. She's number six on the all-time USA caps list with 255.
Hold on. Did you say she's sixth in the list of most capped American players?
Yes.
This is what I was saying is that that's basically club level number of games. And it's incredible that the women are clocking in that many national team games. And no wonder the national teams are so strong and the club teams are so disjointed because you're getting this incredible number of games on the national level. You're playing with the same, 23, let's say. And that just blows my mind that she's sixth with 255 caps.
Number one is Christine Lilly with 354.
What? Jeez,
I don't think I've played 354 soccer games in my life. I'm injured too much. That might also be why some people think the U.S. team won't be as dominant going forward because the club game is kind of taking off.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. And another interesting thing to note about Abby as you discuss her legacy is that the 2015 World Cup is the only World Cup that she won. Early in 2003, they lost in 2007, they lost in 2011, although she did score the greatest American goal of all time in that World Cup against Brazil, that header with the cross from Rapinoe. Leading into the 2015 World Cup, it was the third season of the NWSL, and Abby chose to not play a club season. Let me just repeat that again. The captain of the U.S. national team, one of the greatest players of all time, said, I'm not going to play a club season leading into this World Cup. She alludes to it actually being due to problems in her marriage. This wasn't a highly criticized decision, although it was so early in the NWSL, the third season, which relied so heavily on the faces of the U.S. women's national team player, that for Abby Wambach to say, nope, I'm not doing it. I'm just prepping for the 2015 World Cup. You could argue she took someone's roster spot on that team, but everyone wanted so badly for Abby finally win her World Cup. And she knew she might be riding the bench for part of it. And she was really, really gracious about it. It really ended kind of in that positive way. So, when we talk about the greatest American player, these are some of the things that, not only the goals record.
Is her legacy different if she doesn't win that World Cup?
I think she'd still be number one because the stats are really hard to deny. But the U.S. won the 2008 gold medal in Beijing, and she wasn't there. The things that she doesn't win really shaped who she was. And also, I think the public love for her of wanting, she deserves this so much.
Right.
Would it change her legacy? I think there would always be a, well, but she only won two Olympic gold medals.
Bit of an asterisk, yeah. This issue of personal responsibility, so-and-so player hasn't won something, that means they're not the greatest, but it's really a team sport.
Like Messi, yeah.
But Messi not winning a World Cup will be why he's not the greatest of all time, even though there's maybe nobody who's done what he's done in history before that, right? But we look at titles, we look at these big things. And I wonder how much of that she internalized and drove her to her later demons, just because to be so great but not be able to take your team past that line, what does that do to a person?
That 2011 Women's World Cup loss in the final on penalties to Japan, it goes even further. I mean, she essentially was the only U.S. player that converted their penalty in the shootout. And Hamari Sawa's equalizer, which was a sublime goal. I watched it many times last night in the 117th minute to tie it. It looks like it actually glances off Abby in its way into the gold. To not only not win these things, but to be, the person whose mark on the corner is blown, or who, you're in the shootout and you're one of four players that converts, and the internal processing that must go along with that is heavy. And I'm sure absolutely that played a role in everything that, she's turned out to be.
Any other thoughts here?
I did put together my top five American players. It was not easy. There are two men on my list, which I had to give them a bit of a handicap, but that's just the world that we live in. So Abby's number one, far and away.
Like that.
Number two is a purely sentimental DeMarcus Beasley.
That's spicy. That's a big take.
I will die on this hill. Absolutely. Okay. number three, Mia Hamm. She's got 0.57 goals per cap. Carly Lloyd is number four at 0.42 goals per cap. Obviously, still an active player. And then Landon Donovan comes in at number five with 0.36 goals per cap. Not one of my favorite players emotionally, but he's part of the conversation for sure in terms of stats.
Here's the thing. Naming all those great players that you've just named, she is definitely top. And I would say, want to do spicy takes, I reckon she might be top 20 target forwards to ever have existed.
Yeah.
I'm going to say top 20 just to be safe because I haven't really thought about it before. I'm going to say top 20 target forwards to ever exist because there aren't that many good ones and that were like so prolific.
Hanny, to your point about Abby being a target forward, she did mention in her memoir that she has one eye that's nearsighted and one eye that's farsighted. You know, when you think about the goals that she scored and the variety of ways that she scored them, I think that is absolutely a superhero advantage.
Built-in bifocals. That's wild. All right, let's end on that.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you'd like to tweet at us, you can tweet at us at Justin Salhani and at This Is Hanny Jabber and at Jessica Malone 85. Jess, it was awesome to have you.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is so fun.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again. Maybe on the DeMarcus Beasley episode.
On the DeMarcus Beasley episode, yeah, absolutely.
Where we have to knock him off the two spot, honey.
Please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and we'll see you soon. I am